Welcome back to the Brexit Brits Abroad podcast. I'm Dr. Michaela Benson, a reader in sociology at Goldsmiths, University of London, and the research lead for a UK and a Changing Europe funded project that's all about what Brexit means for British citizens living in the EU27. Today, I'm talking with Helen McCarthy. Helen worked with Migration Policy Institute doing the research for the Next Steps report that we published with them in April 2018. And she also is the author of a report published later that year in November 2018 called The End of the Retirement Dream, which is all about Brexit and potentially what it might mean for British pensioners living in the EU. Helen, do you want to start by talking a little bit about the research that you did back then?
Yeah, sure. So I suppose my role, I was brought on kind of providing a bit of support to the team at MPI, and my role was to try to interview Spanish officials around their planning for Brexit and what they were doing in the lead up to that. And it actually proved really difficult to find the right people to talk to when we were contacting people. In most cases, it seemed like they hadn't really started thinking about what was going to happen. This was in late 2017, and it seemed like planning was really, either it was being kept very sensitive because it was sort of politically, people didn't want to speak to us because the sort of line was, we're holding the Commission's line and we can't talk. You know, member states weren't talking or thinking individually, but it also seemed like just they hadn't really started thinking about it. And so then when I came to write this specific brief on pensioners, it was kind of similar in the sense that a lot of the specific issues around sort of pensions and financial services and tax and things like that, I was really struggling to find kind of authoritative and clear information about what would actually happen in various scenarios, because essentially no one knew, even more so in the case of a no deal, that seemed to see adding even more uncertainty.
I think that that's a really familiar interpretation of things now after the event. Well, not after the event, because we still don't really know quite what's going to happen. But I think around the kind of the fact that this is so unprecedented in terms of kind of undoing a whole load of things and then making sure that people can still live their lives the way they had been, those two things don't really seem to be very compatible in lots of ways. And certainly in terms of law and legislation, it seems to be a lot more challenging than people might have anticipated. But we're now in 2019. So coming up to 2 years since you started to try and do that research. And also we're in a week where we've got a new prime minister and a new cabinet, and no deal looks increasingly more likely. Do you think anything's changed in terms of the way that those kind of local national figures in Spain are thinking about no deal? Because I'm sure that they have some plans now.
Yeah, so I think obviously we've seen various member states sort of publishing and putting forward their sort of no deal legislative plans. And we've also seen in some cases a bit more clarity on the UK side about what they're going to do. And I think also in the meantime, yeah, one of the big unknowns was sort of like what private businesses were going to do in terms of like financial services providers. Because one of the questions was around insurance providers having licenses to pay out annuities for people who were living overseas if the provider was UK based. And I think in most cases now, companies have had enough time where they've set up subsidiaries or different entities that based in the EU, so they're going to be able to continue to provide services and honour those contracts.
Those are contracts relating to people's private pensions.
Yes, exactly. And so I think that was, and again, you know, when we were talking about the sort of preparations, I think that's one of the things about no deal is it relies on so many different bodies doing things, not just the governments in various cases, but also private companies and different regulatory bodies all making decisions and making things happen. And then what you also have is, of course, if national governments decide something, then you need those decisions to filter down onto the local level. And so I guess that's one of the big unknowns about what will actually happen if we do move into a no deal scenario. I suppose first of all of that legislation in those countries would need to be passed, and then the kind of provisions in them would actually need to filter down to people who are actually providing services. So in Spain, I know that they are saying that people will still be able to, if they're currently registered for healthcare, they'll still be able to access healthcare until the end of 2020, even in a no-deal scenario. And I think in terms of residency, that's also, there's going to be a period in which people will still be able to apply for residency, even if they don't have it yet. But each country, it's obviously, the situation's quite different. And even what was interesting in Spain, so in Spain has this, well, they call it the Convenio Especial, which is a sort of system where you can pay to have access to the national healthcare system if you're not working. So that would potentially provide an option instead of private healthcare insurance for some people. But that also seems to vary by region. So Andalusia, you can't apply for that anymore. And anyway, you can only apply for it if you've been resident there for a year. So
that's really interesting, because I think that I've seen similar kind of discussions about how things kind of, what's the word, how they come down to the local level in France, and the kind of differences between the ways that different municipalities permit things or don't permit things, what they require of people to demonstrate that they're eligible for X opportunity or X permit or what have you. So it's really interesting to see that that's also the case in relation to this particular healthcare provision in Spain. One of the things I really liked about your report was this playing on the idea of this, of Brexit being the end of the retirement dream. And this, it was a question, really, wasn't it? And I think it is something that's been circulated around quite a lot. I've seen several media reports over the last 3 years which say, well, is this the end of British retirement migration to Europe? And I wondered if you had any further reflections on that post, you know, a few years on from that, and really what the challenges were, I suppose, is a good starting point in thinking about what Brexit might mean for people who are retired and have migrated.
The first thing to say is probably that one of the distinctions we made in the report, and I think it's maybe a bit of a generalisation, but it's still quite a useful distinction to help us think about these issues, is between what we called lifestyle retirees, so people who had basically lived most of their lives in the UK, lived and worked in the UK, and then migrated after they had retired, usually to southern European countries, kind of for the lifestyle, for the sunshine, those kind of things. And British citizens who have lived and worked and then in European countries, EU 27 countries, and then retired there. And we call those in situ retirees. And they face a completely different situation in terms of their rights, probably post-Brexit, and then the people who've kind of migrated post-retirement.
I think that what you highlight there is a difference between people who have basically earned and paid into a system in one place all of their life. And then a colleague of mine who's based at St. Thomas's University in Canada refers to this as geographic arbitrage, how they take all of those resources that they've accumulated there and they kind of relocate them somewhere else to support a life there. And then the structures that really support that. So that's Matthew Hayes. He talks about geographic arbitrage versus people who've actually been, for want of a better word, economically integrated into the labour markets in the countries that they've lived in, and therefore have access to sets of rights through having worked and paid into the systems in those countries. I mean, obviously, it's, as you said, it's a very broad distinction that probably underplays the complexity of it, but there are different sets of rights associated with that. So what are they?
Yeah, so I think the main one concerns healthcare in terms of, yeah, how you access your healthcare. So most people who migrated after they had retired, at the moment, based on the reciprocal arrangements of the EU, the UK pays for their healthcare. I mean, so they have this S1 form, which provides them with entitlement to access the healthcare in the country that they move to on the same basis as the citizens of that country. And the cost of that is borne by the UK. Whereas in other countries, lots of European countries, you know, their healthcare is arranged in a slightly different way to the way it is here. It's not all completely free on access. But if you've been working in a country, you're usually kind of integrated into that healthcare system. And then when you retire there, you maintain your rights to healthcare through that national system on the basis of the fact that you have worked and paid into the social security there. And of course, if those lifestyle retirees sort of lose their S1 entitlement, you know, overnight, it's sort of based on the idea that the UK would have to agree reciprocal deals with all of these countries. And as we mentioned, like, some places have set out fairly generous periods of leeway in which, you know, nothing will change, whereas other places it's a much shorter period, and, you know, it might still anyway require afterwards that people are going to have to pay a certain amount in order to have the healthcare coverage that you know, before they weren't paying for.
And as yet, some of that's uncertain in terms of what people will actually have to do in the event of no deal, as much as it's also the case that although measures have been put in place so that people can pass emergency legislation, the legislation has not been passed yet in respect to those individual deals. That's basically the crux of the problem. So in the case of no deal, then, the people who are most vulnerable to that change are those who rely on those S1 entitlements rather than people who've paid in to the national healthcare systems in the place that they live.
Yeah, I think that's correct. And then, of course, you know, there's this uncertain category, unknown, which we think does exist as well, of people who maybe are moving between the UK and EU countries, maybe spending half of their time in each place, and who may actually be using a completely different system to access their healthcare, their European health insurance card, which is not actually supposed to be used in this way. It's supposed to only provide cover for sort of emergency treatment if you're on holiday. But there is an idea that quite a few people probably have been using this as a way that they accessed their healthcare, even if they were resident for quite long periods in other EU countries. And so that provision will completely fall away in the event of no deal.
I think that points really well to some of the complexities around what no deal means, first of all, but also just by taking that one example of healthcare, and it is just one example of highlighting the very different conditions under which people have been able to live their lives until now, and therefore the possible challenges that Brexit always presented to those, as well as the additional challenges that are likely to be faced in the case of no deal. I also think that in highlighting those issues around private pensions, for example, and the kind of insurances related to that, you've highlighted really well the fact that there are certain things that, of course, are within the power of the different governments to legislate and to bring into force and to encourage. But also it involves such a wide range of different actors and different companies and corporations and different issues that, you know, that's only like the tip of the iceberg, really, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. And when I started looking into it, you know, there's so many different areas that you could probably spend a lot of time digging into. For instance, tax residency. A lot of EU countries have different laws around tax for EU or non-EU citizens. And of course, suddenly this comes into play after Brexit. You know, UK citizens will no longer be EU citizens, so they may face different tax implications in terms of income they're getting from abroad, or if they choose to sell a property in that EU country in order to move back to the UK, they may face a different capital gains tax, which is, you know, at a different level than it is now. So there's just like a huge array of different areas of complexity, and that also then all vary across the EU 27 countries.
I think that's really, really helpful, not least in just laying out that breadth of complexity. But on the other side of things, you've also been working with Spanish nationals living in Britain in a time of Brexit. And I wondered if you had any reflections from that that you would like to share.
Yeah, so one of the things that was interesting, in fact, one of my respondents said this to me when I was asking him how he felt about Brexit and his future in the UK. He was sort of like, well, I think we'll be okay, partly because we're the one country where there's more Brits in Spain than there are Spanish in the UK. And so he was kind of seeing that that was going to play in the favour of Spanish citizens in the UK because the UK wouldn't want to disrupt the situation for their citizens in Spain. I mean, I think on the whole, they're quite often contrasted, the demographic profiles of migration between Spain and the UK, because the sort of stereotype is that old British people go to Spain, whereas it's young Spaniards that are coming to the UK. And we're sort of living with the uncertainty. I think a lot of people, there is that sense of that feeling of rejection that people have and you know, a slight questioning of their place. But it doesn't necessarily come out as a very sort of existential. They sort of tend to express it maybe in quite a flippant way. They're like, well, if you don't want me here, I'll just go. If I, you know, if things become difficult, I'll just leave. And they kind of make it sound like it's not a very big decision to actually, you know, uproot your life and change country after you've been building a life, you know, in a certain place for a while. But it might also reflect the fact that, yeah, quite a lot of my participants were young people. Quite often they had come sort of on a bit of an adventure, you know, to work and to learn English, but it was kind of seen as somewhat temporary, open-ended plans, this whole idea that we have with EU migration, that quite often it is quite open-ended. And so Brexit was just sort of feeding into part of that, like, well, if I have to change my plans because of this, then I will, but I don't think that I will have to. There was a sort of still sense that this was also back in 2017 that I conducted these interviews. So people still had this idea that pragmatism and would prevail. Yeah, so it'd be quite interesting to revisit that. But yeah, certainly people, I think the vote does change a bit how people, somewhat the perception of the UK as a whole and people's attitudes to migrants and immigration. And most people did say they'd known someone who had left, and also that people who were planning to come from Spain were no longer going to come. So yeah, it has changed people's attitudes to the UK to some degree.
I think that's really interesting because it does accord a little with the findings of the work that Mike Danby was doing for us in Spain with young British people living in Spain. So that was work with 18 to 35 year olds living in the south of Spain. And to a certain degree, there was similarly that kind of sense of their movement as having been open-ended, of them like moving around in search of work, that kind of shaped their understandings of where they were in a really different way to what you might find with people who are making a one-off move that is intended to be permanent. But also that the ability to live with that uncertainty of where they would be in 6 months' time equipped them quite well to deal with any further uncertainties either produced by political transformation or by legal transformation. And I wouldn't want to kind of overemphasize that too much, but it did really seem that because they operated in a quite different economy, I think, to the assumptions that were supported by freedom of movement, which was intended as a way of integrating a European labour market that was probably, I imagine, to be quite permanent, that actually these weren't people that were exercising freedom of movement in the way it was intended anyway. And so Brexit perhaps didn't have the same consequences for them, other than the fact that, of course, it's not just a legal transformation. There's a whole host of other transformations that go alongside that, which then can change anyone's life, essentially. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I think it does. I mean, I would say the one thing I guess I didn't really talk about previously, but when you were talking about it, I was thinking about it, is that I did see actually a difference, though, between within my participants. I was interviewing Spanish citizens who were born in Spain, and this was kind of more or less their first migration to the UK. And I was also interviewing Spanish citizens who were born in Latin America. So these were usually people who had come from Latin America to Spain, had usually lived a decade or more in Spain and naturalized as Spanish citizens, and then who had come onwards to the UK after the financial crisis. Mm. And they tended to, I mean, what I found in my research was they tended to have quite different attitudes to their future plans in the UK. They were sort of a bit more committed to the UK and more certain, and you know, they were prepared to do whatever it took to, in terms of applications and whatever, they were just going to do it and in order to stay, and they were planning longer futures in the UK. And I think that, I mean, I was speculating about why it might be. I think there's, you know, a number of explanations you could come up with, but I think on the one hand, they were already sort of used to thinking of themselves as migrants. They'd already gone through that whole process in Spain. And so the idea that they, when they were here and they were asked to do another application form, well, it's just an application form. They'll do it to in order to stay.
And you didn't find that so much with the Spanish nationals who had been born in Spain?
For the most part, people said they were going to do whatever they needed to do, of course. But I think there were some people who felt sort of a bit more of a sense of like, why should we have to do this when we've come under certain conditions? Why should we have to prove our rights or prove ourselves again in order to stay? As I said, like, I think when you actually came down to it, people were going to do the applications, whatever it was. I mean, at the time, it was all very unclear what that was going to be. And, you know, everyone was applying for permanent residency. And then it came out that maybe permanent residency wasn't going to be the right thing. And then they launched settled status. And then actually permanent residency, you can just convert it. But the permanent residency application form was very long. And so I think there was a certain amount of that feeling of like, why should we go through this complicated process from some individuals. I mean, obviously not across the board by any sense, but yeah, it came out particularly in the survey data, those kind of responses more from those born in Spain compared to those born in Latin America.
I think what you're pointing to is responses framed by very different experiences. And what you've described really is a case of people who'd already had to demonstrate their right to be somewhere and had probably had to make difficult decisions around migrating and leaving the countries that they were born in the first place, and had to learn how to tell themselves in particular ways to gain access and to maintain residence in places, versus people who have never been questioned for that right before. So it's a very almost an existential response, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. I think you don't want to paint too broad brush of a picture, because obviously within that group of Latin American Spanish citizens, you do find a lot of people who leave quite soon after they arrive because, you know, things don't work out in the UK. But among my interviewees, the people, they felt like the UK offered them so many opportunities that they were just really kind of committed to the longer term. And as you say, maybe having had to already make those quite difficult decisions and being at a different stage in life quite often, because they were usually a bit older, they had children. So they were sort of weighing things up for their whole family, thinking about where was the best for their future. Yeah, they were sort of very emphatic about being in the UK and staying in the UK. And often they were the ones saying, if I can, I'll become a British citizen. That sort of was, you know, what they felt like was the sort of end goal, even though, interestingly, this potentially has different legal implications for them as already being dual citizens with Spanish citizenship compared to those Spanish citizens who were born as Spanish citizens. But that's maybe a bit of a complicated issue. Maybe I shouldn't get into that too much.
Well, it is the case, isn't it, that quite a lot of those Latin American countries are exempt from the rules in Spain about dual nationality, so they can take dual nationality. Whereas, for example, officially, British citizens applying for Spanish nationality would have to renounce their British citizenship. And I think that's what you're kind of pointing towards in a way. Do you think that there is something about people's capacity to live with uncertainty that is part and parcel of those responses, or that shapes those responses? I mean, I wouldn't want to get too deterministic about it because it could go down that route. But I was thinking from the point of view of, if you have genuinely never really been questioned for your right to be anywhere, then to suddenly find that there is a big question mark over that initially is going to be met with shock. I mean, that's an obvious response in some ways. Whereas for other people, it's a little bit like that, you know, the flexibility of these young people to be open-ended and move on, whereas other people are not open-ended. They've put a lot more planning into that. So do you think there is something there about those past experiences feeding and shaping their responses and reactions?
Definitely. It's linked to your past experiences and your, yeah, how you've had to sort of navigate other migration regimes. But I think it's also maybe linked to your class or education level as well, because the people I tended to find who were sort of expressing the most concern and worry about the Brexit uncertainty were the people who were the highly educated, highly skilled people who were doctors or engineers, who in all likelihood are not going to face any issues in a kind of post-Brexit, any kind of post-Brexit immigration regime. They would probably be the ones who would be welcomed. Whereas people who were at the lower end of the labour market seemed less worried, which was sort of slightly paradoxical. And it wasn't clear to me whether this was partly to do with sort of knowledge and awareness and the fact that a lot of these, you know, highly skilled people by their own admission were doing lots of reading and research and, you know, following the news very closely. And that was sort of part of the thing that was generating their concern. And whether it was just that if you're just working in cleaning, struggling to make ends meet, you don't really have time to follow the news and think about these things in so much detail. Whether it's that or whether it's also and linked to just, yeah, if you've kind of living in a more precarious life, you're sort of more used to external factors coming and things that you can't control, making your life complicated and changing it in ways, you know, beyond your control. You know, for a lot of these Latin Americans who were in Spain, they'd really established their lives there and they'd spent a certain amount of time overcoming. Sometimes they'd been irregular and they'd regularized and then naturalized. And, you know, it'd been a bit of a process and really had established themselves and bought flats and had decent jobs. And then the financial crisis comes. And suddenly that was an external event again, which sort of threw people's lives into a certain amount of disarray and uncertainty. And maybe that's it's also the experience of that that makes people kind of saying, okay, well, this is another thing that's come to, that we sort of have to just deal with, and but kind of by taking one day at a time almost.
I think that really usefully points to the social stratification of those EU citizen communities, much as the British communities that live in the EU. And I think it also does point very, very clearly as an analysis towards thinking about who actually gets impacted by those types of external factors, and that Brexit is not the only thing that's happened in people's lives. And in some cases, it will just be one of many big political transformations that shape the course of their lives and change their status, essentially, or their ability to stay put as much as their ability to move on. So thank you. That's really, really helpful. And thanks for a fantastic conversation.
Thanks for having me.
You've been listening to the Brexit Brits Abroad podcast, hosted by me, Dr. Michaela Benson, and produced by Emma Halton at Art of Podcast. The series is part of a UK and a Changing Europe funded research project, Brexit Brits Abroad, that's all about what Brexit means for UK citizens living in the EU27. We're really keen to hear from you about the issues and concerns we address in the programme, so please do get in touch with any thoughts, queries and questions. You can find our contact details on our webpage, Brexit Brits Abroad, or get in touch via social media. We're on Twitter at BrexpatsEU. And we have a Facebook page, Brexit Brits Abroad. Finally, in case you're not already subscribed to the podcast, you can do so on both iTunes and Google Podcasts. Thank you for listening, and I'll be back in a couple of weeks with the next episode.